Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
When you have a state-owned bank, you have the concept of service to the people. And I know that service is built into, you know, national banks. I'll talk about their service to the community. But really, their primary motivation is return to their shareholders is their number one priority. With a state-owned bank, service to the people of the state can be your number one priority. And it has allowed the state of North Dakota to do any number of different policies and fund those policies at a much lower cost than they would have been able to do if the municipality had to sell on the open market. They were able to borrow from the state bank. The bank was able to support many state institutions.
That's our guest today, Dr. Roseanne Junker, one of the most knowledgeable experts on the publicly owned Bank of North Dakota, who will join us in a reprise and extended interview with Ellen that goes into the history of how this miracle on the prairie got started and why and how it has continued its incomparable success over 10 decades of economic upheaval. Hello and welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. This new year is shaping up to be an exciting new step forward for public banks in the U.S., as about 30 different serious initiatives are being fielded in cities and states across the country. While North Dakota has had the sole distinction of having its own publicly owned bank, it's highly possible that it will not remain alone in that category for too much longer. This centennial year will see the expansion of efforts to educate the public and elected leaders around the country about what public banking is and how it works, and what sort of impacts it can make on an increasingly serious and unsustainable financial pressure, not just on public resources, but also on the options before us to address the chronic deficiencies in credit and finance for the people and communities around the country. Something's got to give, and one of the key things is the private lock on issuance and hoarding of capital and its profits. Since 80% of Americans are living on the edge of their means, our financial system has demonstrated its failure to serve our nation fairly and responsibly, and has displayed for all to see how the financial world is rigged for profits, not for service. The Public Banking Institute will be launching and participating with organizations around the country in a new national campaign for public banks, which will educate and unite organizations around supporting creation of public banks in cities, counties, and states, and provide support and encouragement to those elected officials who have to face off the powerful banking interests that would keep the current self-serving regime in place. And the message is already on its way to Congress in the form of a policy direction called the Green New Deal, which is also being engaged internationally, in Europe and elsewhere, as the people start to get their game together to face off the global banking cartel. Make no mistake, this is going to be an important year for all of us to take our personal democratic power seriously and to push forward against both the resistance and the deflective steps that will try to keep the people from remembering one simple truth. It's our money. We think you'll enjoy today's extended conversation with Roseanne Junker as we take a look back over the 100 years of the Bank of North Dakota and what it means in the 21st century.
Well, Ellen, here we are in 2019, the 100th anniversary of our Friends on the Prairie, the Bank of North Dakota, a history of remarkable performance and effectiveness, and now perhaps the year of starting a whole new frontier of public banking in America. We're calling this the year of the public bank. This was quite a nice conversation we had with Dr. Junker, with Roseanne, to look back on.
Right, and it seems to me that it's actually more relevant now than it was when we did that interview, because we're actually at the point setting up some public banks, and so people are looking at the nuts and bolts of how did they get set up and what obstacles did they face. And as Roseanne points out, people will say, well, California isn't North Dakota or New Jersey isn't North Dakota, but the principle is the same, that we are suffering under the load of out-of-state banks that are not only siphoning off our profits and using them to serve their shareholders, but it does not allow the states to do what they need to do for their own people. In other words, if we had control of our own money, we could not only be making profits off it for the state and for the people, but we could be directing that money into those sectors that particularly need support, where we need the money, all relevant.
Yeah, the historical recollection of what the Bank of North Dakota did for those people in the Depression, having their own bank enabled them to recover in a much quicker way. It was really fascinating to hear the sort of struggles that the people went through to create the bank.
And it puts a positive light on the struggles we're going through now, because change really only happens in a crisis, as has famously been said. So you can see it in France, for example, where the people are taking to the streets, or Brexit in the UK and Spain and Italy. Occupy Wall Street triggered this whole pointing a finger at Wall Street, not just Wall Street, but the Federal Reserve. It used to be the Fed was sort of this holy temple where everybody worshipped. I mean, it was called the temple by William Grider in his book, Secrets of the Temple. And now people are very suspicious of the Fed, and we're becoming more aware that they're not necessarily serving our interests and they're serving the bank's interests. So when you have a crisis and when people are worried about their money, and we clearly need a debt jubilee, as Michael Hudson says, that it's the nature of our money system. And the way I got into all this was I wrote Web of Debt, which was basically about how banks, not the government, actually create our money supply. And they create the principal, but they don't create the interest. So necessarily, debt is going to grow faster than GDP or than, you know, real things. And so the boom and bust cycle, either that the whole thing has to collapse, which is how our system works today, or you need a debt jubilee where you need to forgive the debts at the end of these cycles. And that's what happened historically, you know, in ancient history, according to Michael Hudson. And we need to do that again in some way. So I just wrote an article on how the Federal Reserve could use its quantitative easing tools to do a universal basic income, which seems to me is the fairest way to do a debt jubilee. If you give everybody a sum of money and you require that it go to pay down debt for those people who are in arrears on their debts, then not only will you effect a form of debt jubilee, but that money that goes to pay down debt will not increase the money supply. So you don't have to worry about inflation. What happens when you pay down debt is the money disappears. Debt money is created as debt, and it is extinguished when the debts are paid off.
So that those monetary principles, people are getting more familiar with and starting to understand in a whole new way. And now this year we see, even at the congressional level, talk of public banks, talk of making perhaps even the Federal Reserve, nationalizing it as a public bank. And the understandings that have happened since we started working on the public bank movement a number of years ago have been tremendous. The strides are considerable. So now not just the people on the prairies of North Dakota, Dakota, but around the country are actively engaged in creating some new banking structure that plays to the understanding you just expressed about how money gets created and our ability to, and really our right to be able to generate the money for public interest and for ourselves as opposed to private profits. So this year is a very pivotal one and a very exciting one, and I think this conversation that we had with Roseanne speaks so much to the struggle of how people make change, as you're suggesting. She illustrates beautifully how the bankers in North Dakota love that bank.
And that is one of the keys to getting a bank set up, is don't try to compete with your local banks, partner with them. So that's a proven model. Other models have been proposed, but this is one that's definitely been proven to work. So
I think what we're seeing here in this 100th anniversary is a new phase of public awareness about money and banking, building on this great tradition of what's happened in the prairies of North Dakota 100 years ago.
What's particularly inspiring about the Green New Deal, besides the fact that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has for the first time introduced public banking in Congress as an actual funding mechanism for the things that people need, it's just the momentum and the dynamism of this millennial generation. We saw it in Los Angeles with the push for a city-owned bank. And we can see it with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who is saying, we need action now. We can't do the usual thing where it's a baby step here, a step forward and half a step back or whatever. We've got to take action. So I've seen it said that you just have to wait for the old people to die off and then the young people take over. So hopefully some new ideas and new energy and new inspiration is coming up with this new generation.
This is going to be an exciting time, and Ellen, I want to congratulate you for helping to bring all this to us, and I'm looking
and
forward
you.
To this is a great interview. I think people are going to really enjoy listening to Roseanne, and every one of our programs during this year is going to have some feature or focus on the Bank of North Dakota's operations and or public banks, what's going on with the campaign to create new American banking institutions in the public interest. Thanks,
Ellen. Right. I'm inspired. My guest today is Dr. Roseanne Anderson-Junker, an expert in the very interesting topic of the Bank of North Dakota. Roseanne holds a doctorate in history, political science, and anthropology, and is the author of The Bank of North Dakota, An Experiment in State Ownership. She's also featured in an excellent documentary by Prairie Public Broadcasting called The Bank of North Dakota, and we are fortunate to have her as a lead speaker at our first Public Banking Institute conference in Philadelphia in 2012. It's great to be talking with you, Roseanne.
Thank you, Ellen. I'm pleased to be here.
So the Bank of North Dakota has been generating a lot of interest lately. It's the nation's only state-owned depository bank, and according to the Wall Street Journal, it is more profitable than JPMorgan Chase or Goldman Sachs. So that disproves the notion that the government can't run a business profitably, as you often hear. And now that we've had an oil bust for the last couple of years, the notion has also been disproved that the Bank of North Dakota was successful only because of oil, because North Dakota itself, had an oil boom. So that's no longer true. And yet, at the end of last year, which reported its most profitable year ever, in fact, they've had record profits every year for the last 12 years, like every year is better than the last one. So attempting to follow their lead, there are like 20 states and a number of cities and counties that have brought bills of one sort or another for a state-owned bank. And at the Public Banking Institute, we're always getting inquiries on it, how they did it, what sort of opposition they faced and all that. So you're an expert on all that, so that's why I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you. But before we get into that, I wondered if you wanted to just say a little bit about how you got into it and, what your connection is to North Dakota and the bank and so forth.
Well, I got into it. It was my dissertation topic when I was doing my dissertation, and I grew up on a farm in North Dakota, and I also went to my local bank, the Bank of Hamilton, which is up in Pembina County, for student loans when I started as a freshman at Jamestown College in North Dakota. And the local bank, it was a small community bank, said, We don't give you a loan. You need to go to the Bank of North Dakota in Bismarck for your student loans, which I did. And they were fabulous. I paid them off. I just was looking at their 2015 report, and they have $1.8 billion in student loans. It's right up there with the commercial loans. It's phenomenal.
Wow, that's one of my many questions. We're actually, you know, of course, always trying to. We're always talking about a state bank here in California, and then but then people say, oh well, we can't do student loans because they're too risky. The students are liable to default, and we can't do homeowner loans because they're too risky. They're liable to default, and small businesses, they're risky. So how is it that the Bank of North Dakota has managed to be profitable with all that? But maybe I'm jumping ahead of the gun. Maybe
yeah. Let's go back a little bit. I think
yeah, we're going there.
Because it is important when you look at California, we're really looking at 100 years ago. The bank was formed in 1919. So comparing North Dakota and California is a little bit like apples and oranges. But let's go back and look at North Dakota in 1915, 1916.
If I could just say one thing, you know, yeah. People say that, you know, well, this is California, it's not North Dakota, so we can't do it. But one thing I know that you'll probably talk about is they had a serious uphill battle, and yet they did it. I mean, it's not like we couldn't do it. We actually have more resources and more possibilities here than they had there, and yet they pulled it off.
I think you're right. I think you're right. All I'm saying is that you probably can't use it as a blueprint for how to establish it. It can be a blueprint for what is established, but the process may be somewhat different. In other words, it will be difficult to do, and some of the struggle may be a different sort of struggle. But let's just look back there. North Dakota had been a state for 30 years when the bank was founded. It became a state in 1889, and it was really a one-crop economy, and that crop was wheat. You had 90% of the people in North Dakota were farming. And also, women didn't have the right to vote. So women weren't engaged in voting for the Bank of North Dakota. It was primarily the farmers who were voting for the bank. And the state had been run primarily by the Republican Party machine. This was the era of big machine politics. And a fellow named Alexander Mackenzie, who was originally from Toronto, was really running the Republican National Committee in North Dakota, and he determined who ran and what industries, etc. He left school when he was 11 years old. He became a scout for General Custer when he was 16, and he ended up running the Republican Party. Now, for 30 years after statehood, there were a number of organizations and political movements that really tried to get rid of the graft, if you will, the control of North Dakota's banking, grain storage, elevators, and railroads. The control of those three big industries was controlled by out-of-state interests, primarily interests out of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So you had the Farmers Alliance, you had the Independence Party, you had the Populists, the Progressives, the Farmers Union Cooperative Movement, the Grange, all trying to break the hold of the Republican Party on state politics. And they slowly, slowly, slowly eroded that hold. Now, farmers like to complain. And even in the good years, I mean, I know from whence I speak, I guess I should say this. Even in the good years, there's something to complain about. Even if they have a good crop, the weather was lousy. So there's a lot of things they can't control. There's the grain markets are national and international. The weather is bad. There's droughts. There was monopoly pricing in the early 1900s. And add to that, the banks were charging the farmers usurious interest rates. In fact, the U.S. Comptroller of the Currency said in 1912 that the rates that the banks were charging, which was a 12% rate, was easily 3% over what was legal. So, and two-thirds of the nationally chartered banks in North Dakota were charging 12% or higher. And I interviewed a state senator who was really a wonderful man who said, you know, I went up to the bank with my dad to get a $100 loan. The bank charged him $20 to make the loan, and then they charged him 12% interest. So he left the bank with $68, you know, on a $100 loan. Right. So, and he says it's things like that that brought the Bank of North Dakota into its being. So out of all these political movements, the one that was actually able to create the bank was the Nonpartisan League. And the Nonpartisan League was started by a fellow named A.C. Townley. Arthur Charles Townley, who had been a farmer in the northwest corner of North Dakota. He'd been a flax farmer, and he was wiped out by a spring snowstorm, a late snowstorm, and decided that, well, he went to work for the Socialist Party, which was organizing and had any number of organizations throughout the state at that time. And he was a good salesman, and he understood that the farmers were too independent to really want to get behind a party. They wanted socialism, but they didn't want the doctrine of socialism. So he created what he called an organizational department, a very benign sounding department, an organizational department within the Socialist Party. And he started recruiting farmers for this organizational department because the farmers liked the idea of a state-owned bank that would loan them their own money, the state's own money, at a much lower interest rate. Well, the Socialist Party didn't like the idea of an organizational development, so they fired Townley. But he continued. He had a good idea. He continued on, and within 4 years, the Nonpartisan League had taken control of state government. They had governor, they had all of the state office holders, they had control of the legislature, both the Senate and the House, and they had control of the state Supreme Court. So they immediately, he drove around the state. I was looking at it. There's probably 100,000 voters at that time. So you can reach quite a number of people if you just have 100,000 voters that you need to reach and you have a good idea. And everybody was being overcharged, and most of the people were farmers. And so, the thing to remember is that he sold not only a state-owned bank, but he sold the idea of a state grain elevator, mill and elevator as well. So not only were they going to finance farming, you're going to be able to sell your grain to a state-owned elevator that was going to pay you a better rate than these out-of-state elevators would have paid you. So
very appealing.
So one, great political organization. And it took probably, I think they started in June. I think by March they had all of the bills legislated. And there was opposition on the floor of the Senate and the House, but they were, of course, outvoted. So they immediately, one of the good things that they did is they hired a banker to run the bank. They hired a fellow named Cathro, who became the director general of the bank, and he had been the first president of the North Dakota Bankers Association. So they immediately turned over the bank to a legitimate banker, not a politician.
They actually did that in Australia with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which was a very successful national publicly owned bank. And when the legislature decided, it was in 1912, and the banks had failed, the private banks had failed, and the legislature decided that they needed a state-owned bank, that the government needed to take it over. So they set up the bank, but again, they did the same thing where they appointed it was the bankers themselves who were nervous about the competition, so they made sure they got one of their own in there to head the bank. But the thing is, he knew how banking worked. He knew that banks just created the money. They just extended credit. And so when the bankers came to him and said, well, you're going to need to borrow from us, you're going to need some loans, and he said, no, I think we're just going to extend the credit of Australia, which he did, and funded all sorts of industries across the country and funded World War I without borrowing from the big banks and the Bank of England, which that was his downfall because he went to England and we went to, the City of London and bragged about that they managed, that they didn't need help. And he had a heart attack at a rather young age soon afterwards.
Financing the bank really was critical. How are they going to, you had the state deposits, but the state deposits weren't nearly enough to meet the needs of the borrowers.
That would be a more challenging proposition than Australia, because that was a country that could issue. The central bank did issue the national currency. So, a state bank has to deal with the national currency. They don't have the power to issue it. So, go ahead.
But what they could issue is they could issue state bonds. And so that was their goal. They immediately tried to issue both real estate bonds the real estate bonds were the most important ones, because the real estate bonds would allow them to fund the farmers' need for equipment, land, buying land, and buying seed. So that was their goal. And so they did a couple of things right away. They agreed not to make loans to individuals. And that's one of the things the state banks asked them. The state bank says, well, we'll work with you, but you can't make loans to private individuals. So the Bank of North Dakota said, okay, but we will make loans to farmers on farmland, but we loan on allowing you to buy a car or a refrigerator or something like that. And they also said, we will redeposit our money back into the local banks. So they became kind of a pass-through bank, if you will. And it was a way to gain the support of the state banks initially, the other state banks initially. So even though the deposits were first, the deposits, the taxation, say, from the municipalities, the taxes went into the Bank of North Dakota, Bank of North Dakota turned around and redeposited them in the local banks so the local banks could make the loans based on that money, and the Bank of North Dakota would buy those loans back. So it was a bit convoluted. That actually, the state banks turned around and stabbed them in the back, and I can get to that in a minute, but the sale of the bonds is what needed to happen. And of course, that meant that the Bank of North Dakota had to go to Wall Street to sell these bonds, or to large investment houses to sell these bonds. And so the Minneapolis interests, the railroads, the grain elevators, and the national banks were not going to take the idea of the Bank of North Dakota lying down. And they created a massive opposition effort, both to discredit the bank, to discredit the bank itself, to discredit the personnel at the bank, and to discredit the people in politics. And they did a number of things. They really wanted to cripple the entire program. So they created a new party called the Independent Voters Association to run against the Nonpartisan League. Mm-hmm. And the Independent Voters Association, which was run out of Minnesota, put on the ballot a referendum of the industrial plan. After the plan had passed, they said, you know, we're going to refer this plan to the voters. We don't think the voters really meant you to do this, even though they elected you on a platform to do this. We don't believe they did. Okay, so the referendum went through, let's see, the bank was passed in 1919. The referendum went through in 1919 in the fall. And the voters said, no, we really did want the industrial measures to go through. We meant what we said, and we said what we meant. Little Dr. Seuss here. So there was also infighting between the members of the NPL, and you had Bill Langer, who became a very famous North Dakota politician and a senator, who quit the Nonpartisan League. He was a very ambitious man, and Townley was a very ambitious man, and there was a lot of ego involved and personal politics involved. And so there were three members of the Nonpartisan League who were elected government officials who quit the NPL, and that sort of power struggle, that crippled the NPL a little bit. So people began to wonder, what's going on here? And then the Independent Voters Association also took to the North Dakota District Court, the State Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court a challenge, saying that the state didn't have the right to create a state-owned bank. Now, they lost in 1920. The U.S. Supreme Court said, well, if the citizens of the state want to do this, then the state can do it. But what was happening was that the opponents were creating all this chaos in the minds of the public, and certainly in the minds of investors, as to whether buying North Dakota state bonds would be too risky of an investment to make. Right. And so every time there was a sale, a possible sale to go through, there's some chaos that they created in the marketplace, and the people would pull back from buying. Now, they eventually went to the labor unions, the national magazines, church groups in Chicago, Michigan, Montana, the locomotive engineers. The North Dakota bond was the farmers union label, the garment workers, the railroad clerks. You had the Clarence Darrow, the lawyer, the ACLU lawyer. You had Alice Stone Blackwell, the suffragette. All of these people, people today we would say are progressives, people on the left, were buying, are trying to buy the state bonds to get the bank operationalized. Well, finally, in October of 1921, there was a recall election of all of the Nonpartisan League. So within 2 years of the bank being established, they had been able to make a few loans. They hadn't been able to make very many loans. You had two planting seasons go by. Farmers were dissatisfied because the loans weren't being made. They didn't know what was going on. And the population voted to recall the Nonpartisan League, and they put in all the Independent Voters Association members. At almost the same time, an investment house in Chicago, Spitzer Rorick bought $6 million of the bonds, and eventually, within a few more months, another $6 million. So they had sold $12 million of the real estate bonds at the very time that the people of the state of North Dakota voted out the Nonpartisan League and put the people who opposed the bank in control of the bank. So it was, yes, we want the bank to continue, but we really want somebody else to run it. And the Independent Voters Association, the new governor, had the opportunity to replace the governing body of the bank, which was elected officials, the governor, the secretary of state, and the commissioner of agriculture, or the industrial commission that serve as the governing board of the Bank of North Dakota. He had the opportunity then to turn that governing board over to a non-political board. And as governor, he said, no, I don't think so. I think we'll just keep it in the hands of the Independent Voters Association. So, I mean, he knew a good thing when he saw it, because it's, I know you mentioned as we began the conversation that for the last 12 years there's been record profits. I think that the bank has probably shown a profit. What is it? It's almost 100 years old. It's shown a profit 90 of those 100 years, if not 95. You know, it has not always made a huge profit. It probably lost money the first couple of years, although through accounting manipulations, they were able to show that they hadn't lost money. It was just on collectible debt. But really, it's never been a drain on North Dakota throughout its entire history.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that actually makes sense when you understand how banking works. You have a choice. Now we know, according to the Bank of England, that banks create virtually the entire money supply, not governments. So you have a choice of borrowing from a private bank and paying them interest, or borrowing from yourself, because states have a lot of money. You know, they have their if they use their own deposits, instead of putting their deposits into Wall Street and letting Wall Street lend them back to them, use them for the basis of their loans, they can borrow their own deposits. So they can do what Wall Street does, which is basically duplicate. You know, the deposits are still there for purposes of withdrawal. And if they're not, you can borrow from other banks or the Federal Reserve or, you know, the backstops. And meanwhile, you can make loans with that same money. Loans of money created on the books as accounting entries.
But the difference is, when you have a state-owned bank, you have the concept of service to the people. And I know that service is built into, you know, national banks. I'll talk about their service to the community. But really, their primary motivation is return on their investment. I mean, their return to their shareholders is their number one priority. With a state-owned bank, service to the people of the state can be your number one priority. And so it allows, and it has allowed, the state of North Dakota to do any number of interesting policy, you know, implement different policies and fund those policies at a much lower cost than they would have been able to do if the municipalities had to sell on the open market. You know, I mean, during the 30s and the 40s, you had a huge depression, and almost half of the people in North Dakota were on some kind of government assistance. I think the average annual income was $145 a year for a North Dakota household. It was 40% below the national average. But schools were issuing warrants to their teachers because they didn't have the money to pay the teachers. Teachers, if they were to take those warrants to the bank took a discount on them, but the teachers could mail those warrants into the Bank of North Dakota, and the Bank of North Dakota paid them the full price for those discounts. A number of the state institutions needed money to continue, like the state school at Grafton, the tuberculosis sanitarium, even some of the colleges needed money to keep themselves running, and they were able to borrow from the state bank. The highway departments needed money. There was just, you know, many, the bank was able to support many state institutions and departments.
So it's sort of like what the
Federal Reserve has done for Wall Street, where they have supported them with all this credit when they were in trouble. So the state is supporting the local.
Yeah, the state really,
businesses, which then pay taxes, so it's all good for the state instead of being a drain on the economy where all the profits are going out to this private banking conglomerate.
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely it does operate like a mini Fed at times for state bankers. The other thing that it did during the 40s, you know, after the war, there was a lot of money put into a lot of growth, city sewers, water, rural electrification, and of course it was able to finance all of those bonds as well. And I was just looking, they've got three new programs on their books this year, and of course part of it has to do with the big oil boom in the western part of the state and not having the kind of infrastructure in place to manage that very well. And it will be interesting to see in the next couple of years how that price of oil shakes out. But I've got no doubt that they've got terrific management. And one of the things I really liked about, I think it's Eric Hartemeyer, who's the president of the bank, and he's been the president for the last 10 years or so. He said, you know, when all of that stuff came around and he was talking about the derivatives and that sort of thing that caused the meltdown in 2008, he says, if we couldn't understand it, we didn't invest in it. You know, and it's such wonderful common sense,
so
right?
So sensible, yeah. This whole thing about the Bank of North Dakota being a socialist institution and North Dakota being a very red state, but it seems to me it's not really. I mean, socialist is the wrong word for it because it's really very capitalist because you've got all those farmers who are individual entrepreneurs, mm-hmm. and they need the support, so they're just supporting each other. It's more like a co-op, but they're supporting each other with their own, instead of allowing this sort of parasitic out-of-state system to draw off all their profits, they're becoming self-sufficient, which is capitalism.
It's one of those easy labels that you can throw on things, and I don't think that this new generation sees the socialism label is, I think that they really look at the Nordic countries more than the, and you know, that's the thing too. I mean, think about North Dakota as North Dakota has been a very independent state. People ran, I mean, the nonpartisan league ran its candidates on the Republican ticket because the McKenzie machine was a Republican machine, but they also ran a few people on the Democratic ticket, just equal opportunity here, just in case. And the populist movement and the progressive movement is very strong, and you have the sense of independence of the farmers, as you mentioned. And you also have people who were primarily Scandinavian heritage with a sense of community and responsibility for a community and helping each other. And you think of it as a red state, but we've had a Democratic U.S. senator for the last 55 years. One of our two senators has been a Democratic NPL senator. And for almost the last 30 years until 2011, and for almost 30 years, we had two Democratic U.S. senators. You know, so even though the state officials may be Republican, the national officials have been for the last 30 years primarily Democrats and not conservative Democrats. So yes, it's socially conservative, but it has a strong sense of political independence as well.
Maybe you could talk a little more about A.C. Townley and how he mobilized the people, because, you know, we've got a couple of leaders that are of that temperament today. We've got Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, who are also sort of populist rabble-rousers. I mean, you know, charismatic
leaders.
It's interesting,
isn't it?
Yeah, because we're at this stage where people are feeling they want change. They don't want to vote for the establishment. They don't like the establishment anymore. They want something new. They're feeling revolutionary, but it's just in terms of people are feeling exploited and they're ready for something might be considered rocking the boat or radical or something. Now they don't like what we've got and they want something new. So how did he manage to?
Well, it's interesting. Townley is an interesting character because you could really say that the Democratic Party and the Republican Party today are the equivalent of the machine politics 100 years ago. You know, they're entrenched, but you do have people that are just tired of politics as usual.
Mm-hmm.
Townley, you know, the Nonpartisan League was probably the high point of his life. He lived another 40 years after the creation of the Bank of North Dakota, and he didn't live a good life. He tried selling any number of things. He ran for office two or three different times, and he never got back on his feet. I can't help but think that losing his farm in 1913 and capturing that spirit of change, those two things combined to make him a very effective speaker.
We get ask a lot of questions just about the nuts and bolts and what the legislation was. The only thing I've seen is like a one-pager, which was pretty simple. I wonder if you could describe what actual bills they passed, you know, how the bank was governed, and you said about the state deposits went into the bank and then they went into the local banks.
There were three bills that were passed in order to start the Bank of North Dakota. One was the enabling legislation, and one was appropriations for the bank itself. And then the third one, the bank was required to start within 90 days after it was signed by the governor. The provisions first state that the bank is to promote agriculture, commerce, and industry, and that's continued to this day. They set up the governing body, the industrial commission of the governing body, and I think I mentioned that the industrial commission was to make and enforce all the orders and the rules and the bylaws, and it's made up of the governor, the commissioner of agriculture, and the secretary of state. It said that the bank can do anything that any bank can legally do, that all of the state, county, township, municipal, and school district funds and funds of the educational institutions, state educational institutions, industrial institutions, and penal institutions all had to be deposited within the Bank of North Dakota within the first 3 months, and that all of the deposits are guaranteed by the state, and that the bank can loan to any of the departments, the institutions, the utilities, business within the state. There was $100,000 appropriated out of the general fund to carry out the provisions, and it was declared an emergency. Now, $100,000, we have to think of what $100,000 was in 1919. It's certainly a lot more money than it was today. The idea that they were to get this bank up and running within 3 months of being enacted, because there people had to put their crops in. They needed money to get their crops in. The whole idea of organizing the bank, it certainly had a lot to do with stabilizing the interest rates and bringing the interest rates down. And the bank immediately caused the interest rates to drop by 3 percentage points. The interest rates immediately went from 12% to 9%.
That happened also with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, too. They forced the private banks to lower their rates, so they set the tone.
You know, it's when you have your priorities straight, right?
What about the city deposits? They don't go in the...
Yes, they do. That was the townships. Municipal and
township. Okay, so they all go in the state bank, and then my understanding was that they partner with the local banks to help with liquidity, but so they actually put the deposits into the local
bank? Well, they did initially. This is an irony, right? They did initially because they wanted the support of the state banks. The director general had been head of the North Dakota Bankers Association. He knew that if these municipalities all put their money in the state bank, the local banks would be losing a lot of their deposits that they used to loan against. And
right.
So he promised to put the municipality money back into these local banks, which he did. Well, during one of the referendums that the Independent Voters Association put on the ballot, it said the municipalities and townships don't have to put their money into the Bank of North Dakota. So all of a sudden, the Bank of North Dakota was losing liquidity. And so it said to the state banks where it had put initial deposits, okay, you guys, give us our money back. And the state bank said, oh, no, we can't do that. And so there's a huge number of state banks that failed. They fell on their own sword. You know, they didn't realize that if they were to create a liquidity crisis in the Bank of North Dakota, the Bank of North Dakota would with back those funds that they had redeposited in the state banks. They would bring those funds back. Hence, the state banks would be in trouble. So the state banks made a mistake, and eventually they cleared it up, but not before a number of state banks failed. They created their own problem.
In California and a lot of other states, for the local banks to take state deposits, they have to put up 110% collateral, and so now the local banks don't want the state deposits because they can't make any money off that. You know, interest rates are so low, the collateral is very short-term federal securities, which they can make almost nothing on. So, but in North Dakota, then, they don't have to do that, right? They guarantee the deposits so that, I mean, the state bank.
The state guarantees the deposits of the state bank. So they're in a sense self-insuring.
So now, effectively, the deposits are all in the Bank of North Dakota, but then they partner with the local banks buying a portion of the loan.
Well, you know, a lot of the local banks make loans which they sell to the Bank of North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota takes those loans from a number of the local banks and packages them and then resells them.
To private investors?
Yeah, yeah.
Cool.
So it really serves, I mean, it really, North Dakota is a small state and there are a number of small banks. And it's kind of like having it's like having a sugar daddy, you know, in your back pocket where you can make these loans and then you sell them to the Bank of North Dakota and you get your money back. And then you can continue to make more loans, sell them to the Bank of North Dakota. North Dakota packages them from around the state and then can sell them to larger banks. So,
or another way of looking at it is that the local banks are really the front office for the state bank, but they're independent contractors or like franchises of the state.
You know, that's a really good way of putting it because the Bank of North Dakota does not have any branches. Mm-hmm. You know, that's one of the things that it agreed to. It only has the bank in Bismarck. It doesn't have any branches around the state, so the state banks really are the Bank of North Dakota's fingers into the local community.
And then people are always writing to me or asking me, can I open an account at the Bank of North Dakota? But of course they can't.
You can. I had
if you're an out-of-state person, can you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know why not. I mean, I had an account there, and it was so funny because, of course, when I was working on my dissertation, Herb Thorndahl was the president of the bank at that time. And he said, why are you having a personal bank account here? You know, you need to get credit. You need to, you know, develop your credit at some place that's going to lend you money. And I said, well, I don't want to borrow any money. I just wanted an account. I still have pencils that say Bank of North Dakota on them. And pencils are 30 years old. Anyway, you can have a savings account. You can have a checking account, I believe. I actually should check that because I'm not quite certain. You could 30 years ago. But again, it doesn't make private loans. If I needed to borrow money for a car, I wouldn't be able to do it. You know, I'd be better off at a credit union or something. So,
mm-hmm. Or you could borrow from a local bank, which then packaged up your loan along with a bunch of others and sold it.
I think it's more probably the real estate loans that the local bank can make the loans on, you know, because it's the real estate loans, small business loans that can be packaged to the Bank of North Dakota, but personal loans are not something that they package. I've come across this statement by the first director general. Remember we were talking about socialism and whether they would oppose the bank on socialism. And of course, this is right during the Russian Revolution and all this stuff was going on at the same time the Bank of North Dakota was started. But this fellow, and remember, he's the banker. He says, our people have resented injustice, but never revolted in a way that indicates a spirit of red revolution. They resort to the constitutional ballot for the redress of their grievances. They are sober-minded, studious, and industrious, and they give careful consideration to their economic problems and decide carefully and wisely. You know, if there's no tendency towards anarchy. People are law-abiding. With no large industrial centers, no large mining towns, and no large congestions of population, there is no chance for Bolshevism to take the place here. You know, he's saying that's not what it's about. What it's about is using people's own money to support them. And you know, Jerry Brown did this when he was governor the first time around, when he had the pension investment unit, and he worked very hard with public and private pension funds to focus their investments on California-based investments. There was every good reason to put the investments of the public employees and the state teachers association based in California. There's plenty of sound California investments for those pension funds to invest in. So it's pretty much a similar idea.
Well, and how is it that the Bank of North Dakota makes, I saw they made a 1% loans to build a school, I think it was the end of 2014. Meanwhile, here in California, we have these capital appreciation bonds that can go to 1,500%, like in Orange County.
Wow.
They're getting in them from Wall Street, from Goldman Sachs. So how is it that the Bank of North Dakota can afford those loans? They take a loss on those? Or?
You know, I doubt they take a loss. On the other hand, they don't have to make a huge profit. They don't have to take a loss. But if the cost of money to them is 0.5% and they're lending something out at 1%, they're not going to take a loss. And yet, I mean, I can't imagine a school in Southern California having to pay that kind of interest.
Yeah, well, it's like 40 years later, and that's how they do it. That's how they get away with it. But I suppose it's just supply and demand, that school boards don't have any other option, and they need whatever, school facilities. And so.
And sometimes you have to give credit to the elected officials of North Dakota to say, here are the things we value. Mm-hmm. And education has always been one of the things that, again, a lot of it comes from the Scandinavian heritage. Education has been one, it's very, very important. You know, think of all the different Lutheran colleges that were started as soon as the Lutheran Church got established in North Dakota and Minnesota. Education has always been an important thing to that population, German as well.
Yeah, it's really part of, somebody called it social infrastructure. You want to educate your people so they can contribute to the economy. So you might think of it as bleeding heart socialism, you know, bleeding heart welfare or something, but it's not.
It's an investment in the future.
It's an investment in the future of the economy, of the state.
Well, the future of your state, because what do you have? What you really have is people. That's all you have. That's all you have is people. And you want to have an educated population. You know, not everybody needs to go to college. Not everybody. You need to have plumbers and electricians, but education in the trades as well as higher education should be the first thing that we invest in, it seems to me, as a state.
And there was the famous example of after World War II, that the GI Bill invested education for the soldiers as well as low-interest home loans and low-interest business loans, and they got their money back 7 times over.
And, you know, North Dakota, through the Bank of North Dakota, created student loans before the federal national student loan. In fact, North Dakota made the first insured national student loan because it already had that in place through the Bank of North Dakota. And they also did the same thing with the returning veterans, loan program for education before the federal program. I mean, it's what do you care about? And by having the bank and being able to invest in social programs using social capital to invest in social programs that supports your economy is essentially what the bank is doing.
And it seems to me you think what you care about and then people think like religious values or something like that, but that's really not it. I mean, the things like investing in education and investing in building things for the people is really supporting the economy. I mean, it's really a practical money-saving investment rather than putting your money into some high-flying thing in Wall Street where in the end you're going to be paying lots of fees that you're not anticipating. I mean, you're always playing with a more sophisticated player than you are, so you can almost count on losing in the Wall Street casino.
It's also, you just manage your risk. And so some things have a higher interest rate than other things, but the things that you want to support, like education or family farms or, you know, your state municipalities, you can support those. You can make loans at a lower rate. Not everything has to be equal. This is a fascinating. I mean, California, there's the same number of people in California as there is in Canada. You know,
there are 50 times as many people in California as in North Dakota.
50 times more?
50.
Yeah, I think there's like 750,000 people here, so that's about right.
Yeah, and in California, just in the Treasurer's investment pool, which is all the slush funds from various government state entities, there's $67 billion. So it's making almost nothing and a huge amount of money. So if you put that in your own bank and called it deposits, then you would be able to create 90% of that in the form of loans. So you could basically double your money. So it's an opportunity.
Well, so where is the political will going to come from to do something like that?
I think there actually is some political will. I mean, you know, we're talking to legislators who are interested, particularly today when California is facing a $700 billion infrastructure bill over the next 10 years. money they just don't have currently. They need some new sources. They can't raise taxes without big protests, and they can't slash services without big protests. So it's the third way. Let's create our own money the way all banks do, by create it out of our own deposits.
You know, the thing is you've got some pretty large banking interests in California as well. You know, that are going to...
But they're out-of-state interests, so it's...
Well, here's the irony, isn't it? When was Wells Fargo acquired by the Minneapolis bank? I mean, that's very funny that we're talking about those Minneapolis bankers.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Bank of America is now a North Carolina bank. Wells Fargo is at least headquartered in California. You know, it's certainly a worthy effort. It's certainly a worthy effort. And
and it's exciting. The possibilities are exciting, that we don't have to be limited to raising taxes or cutting services. There are other ways to design a monetary system. And in fact, the current system is obsolete. It's actually where monetary reform is right now, that all the money reformers are arguing with each other over what the new system should be. But everybody knows that we need a change. It's just a question of devising the most efficient model.
You know, it is efficient. It's greed doesn't have to get into it. You know, I like that idea of a tidy profit. I think you use that in one of your statements, to make a tidy profit. I love that idea. You know, you don't have to maximize, but you can make a tidy profit. And that's somehow all you need to do.
Uh-huh.
You know? So I wish California luck, and I certainly wish the other states and municipalities that are looking at this. I mean, certainly having people who understand the system and who have a experience is critical in the whole effort.
So it's great to be able to get your insight. You've done a whole study on the whole area.
I have, and it's almost time to redo it, you know, because when I finished this, was in the early 80s, the bank had put in $100 million into the state fund. They had generated $100 million for the state fund, and now I'm sure it's probably $500 million by now that they've generated into the state, you know, that they have earned. So not only are they allowing the state to implement all sorts of progressive policies, they're also earning money. I mean, you can't do better than that. You know, that the $100 million in 1980 was literally money that's just given back to the state to do what it wants to, not in the bank itself. They've generated $1 billion in profits. And they're saying over the last 21 years, nearly $400 million has been transferred to the general fund. So that's $500 million. I mean, they generated $1 billion in profit in the last 21 years, but $400 million of that billion has been transferred to the general fund to support education and other public services. So actually, $500 million is not too far off.
Yeah, and considering it's such a small state of 680,000 or whatever, that lot of money. Yeah. Great. Well, it's been great speaking with you. Do you have anything you want to wrap up with? Concluding statement?
Well, I wish you and the public banking movement all the success, because it's obviously worked in North Dakota. There's obviously different situations in different places, but the idea is sound. You know, the idea is sound. So I just say good luck and go for it, and I hope it works. Thank you, Ellen, and all the best.
Okay, same to you.
All righty. Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Roseanne Anderson Junker, author of The Bank of North Dakota, An Experiment in State Ownership.
For more historical information about the Bank of North Dakota, we recommend that you visit YouTube and enter the bank's name, where you'll find an excellent 30-minute public television documentary on it, including an interview with our guest today, Dr. Roseanne Junker. You'll also find materials on this on the Public Banking Institute's website, www.publicbankinginstitute.org. Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Money.